Hello and welcome to the latest podcast in our series, Living with Diabetes, brought to you by Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. In this edition, we're looking at the role of exercise in maintaining good health and management of diabetes. Dr. Rob Andrews talks to us about the challenges and benefits of exercise for people living with type 1 and type 2.
There's very clear evidence that people who have diabetes, if they exercise, will get the benefit that the general population gets, that they're less likely to get cancer, less likely to get dementia, less likely to get heart disease, and just will feel much better. They're less likely to get stress at work.
Marathon runner Frank Rogers relates his experience, which forms the basis for his new book, Running with Diabetes.
I'm living with type 1 diabetes. I know that running is a massive part of how I manage my condition. And if I wasn't running, I know that I would struggle.
We talked to Alison Northern, an implementation manager at the Leicester Diabetes Centre, to discover more about the My Desmond online education course for people living with type 2.
Just a real opportunity for everybody to be learning, looking at ways and how they can all work together and keep each other going during this time, really.
Life under lockdown when you're living with diabetes. We talked to DRWF's Lee Calladine about his type 1 management.
Focus on the NHS guidelines for isolating and protecting yourself from COVID. Stay at home, stay safe.
Plus the latest analysis of the way COVID-19 is affecting people with diabetes. Dr. Partha Kaur explains.
And the average age of death in type 1 diabetes was around 72 years old, and for type 2 diabetes was about 78. As with anything across the board with COVID-19, age continues to be the big determinant.
And it's a challenging time for charities. How is DRWF coping? I spoke with our head of community fundraising, Tim Green, to find out.
We really must not stand still in what is a really difficult time for the country and many charities as well. We must not forget that. But, you know, our focus is ensuring that those living with type 1, type 2 and many other aspects of diabetes is looked after. And so I'd urge anyone listening to this, if you can do something, get involved, however big or small, it really does not matter. We need you to get behind us at a difficult time and really make the difference.
I'm Claire Levy from DRWF, the host of our regular podcast, Living with Diabetes. In this edition, we're looking at the role of exercise in maintaining good health and management of diabetes. Dr. Rob Andrews is a consultant diabetologist and an associate professor at Exeter University. I asked him about the challenges and benefits of exercise for people living with type 1 and type 2 diabetes. Please bear in mind, we recorded this interview just before the current coronavirus restrictions.
So the recommendation for adults living with type 1 and type 2 diabetes is that they do 150 minutes of moderate exercise. And what we mean by moderate exercise is a form of exercise that you're getting slightly out of breath, but not completely out of breath. So you could have a conversation, but in broken sentences. And that you should do two sessions of anaerobic exercise, so weightlifting a week. And that through the day, you should try and break up your sit time so you're not sitting for a prolonged period of time, which is greater than 30 minutes.
And what are the barriers to this kind of activity?
So from people with type 2 diabetes have pretty similar barriers to doing activity as people who don't have diabetes. So the commonest barrier is time. So either the fact that they can't fit it into their personal life because lots of things are going on in their personal life, or that work's getting in the way. And then the other common barriers are expense. So expense to go to gyms, expense to do exercise, and weather is the third commonest barrier. People with type 1 diabetes have slightly different barriers. So the commonest barrier that they express is fear of hyperglycemia, so fear of their blood sugars falling. And then the second commonest thing that they mention is lack of understanding as to how they should adjust their insulin or what they should do with their carbohydrate intake to make sure that they control their blood sugars.
And what effect does exercise have on blood glucose levels for both type 1 and type 2?
So on the whole, for people with type 2 diabetes, little shift in the glucose when you do exercise, but if so acutely, but when you do, if you do exercise regularly, then it will bring down your average level of glucose quite a bit. And if you can do the recommendation levels, then you can get about as effective as two diabetes medications. So about a 1.2% drop in old money, or a 10 in new money. So a good drop. In people with type 1 diabetes, you get an acute effect during exercise. But that depends on the type of exercise. So if you're doing a aerobic exercise, so that's a continuous exercise, so walking, running, cycling, then your glucose tends to fall. But if you're doing an intense exercise, such as weightlifting or high-intensity training, such as doing sprints and things, then your blood sugars can go up. In the chronic, over the long term, some people see an improvement in their general control, but not everybody does, and we think that's probably because they don't always get the right advice about how to change their insulin and their carbohydrate around exercise, so they're a bit more cautious and they tend to just prop their blood sugars up a bit, so they don't see a huge benefit with their HbA1c.
And what are the specific barriers for adults living with type 1, new onset versus established?
So surprisingly, when we did interviews with patients who had type 1 diabetes, as well as having the other barriers that we mentioned, so fear of their blood sugars going down and not sure what to do, they also mentioned that they were worried about going to the gym because they'd be different. So I think that was coming to terms with the diagnosis. And then the other thing that they mentioned was that healthcare workers had told them not to exercise when they were first diagnosed. And unfortunately, quite a lot of healthcare workers never went back and gave them permission to start exercising again. So they had taken away the impression that because of their diabetes, they couldn't exercise.
Patients receive advice from their healthcare professionals. And what does your research show about healthcare professional confidence and knowledge in giving advice about exercise?
So we did a survey that we surveyed just over 200 people, healthcare workers who work in the field of type 1 diabetes. So these are experts in type 1 diabetes. And we had people who were doctors, nurses and dietitians. And what it showed was that doctors were the most confident at giving advice. Next was nurses and the dietitians were the least confident. But then when we went on to test their knowledge, it was the other way around. So dietitians had the best knowledge and were giving the best advice, but doctors unfortunately were the least knowledgeable and not giving the best advice.
And so what do people then do to get the best advice, do you think?
So it is difficult. So there are some websites where you can get information. So we have a website called xtod.org. There's a very good site called RunSuite, which is run by Ian Gallen. And there's another site called xCarbs, which is a very good site. There is a new thing that's been done by the JDRF, which is called JDRF Peak, which is a place where you can go watch videos and things. And then there are some very good patient sources where people can get data. But there hasn't been any uniform documentation that's been produced. We're trying to produce that. So we've done, with funding from the NAHR, we've developed a program for training patients. And a lot of that is going onto our website from that program so that people can get advice.
That's useful. So can you give us an overview then? Who is safe to exercise? What type of exercise should we do? When should we do the exercise? How should we exercise? And why so we should do it?
Yep. So on the whole, exercising, everybody can exercise. The only people that we suggest needs to be checked out before they do exercise and might have some restriction on their exercise are people who have active eye disease. And what we mean by active eye disease is that you are seeing an expert in the hospital who is seeing you about your eyes, so an ophthalmologist. Or that you have an active foot ulcer or active foot problems, then you might have to change what you're doing. It doesn't mean you can't do something. Or that you're having something called postural hypertension. Are you having autonomic neuropathy, which can present as blood pressure dropping when standing, or it can present as flushing when you eat? And those individuals need to just be checked out by a cardiologist, because that's commonly associated with heart problems. Other than that, everybody else can start straight away. But what we recommend is, as we would with all other exercises, is that you start slowly and gradually build up and really listen to your body. So don't, you know, stress yourself right at the start, just build up slowly. In terms of what is the best form of exercise, it depends what you're trying to do. So if you're really wanting to lower your glucose, and that's the prime reason for doing it, then there's clear evidence that that you should do a combination, just like the guidelines are saying, that you should do some anaerobic and some weight training, and that will lower the glucose the most. Again, for a general overall fitness, it's best to be having a variety of exercises that you do during the week rather than one particular one, so that you're exercising all of the muscles rather than particularly focusing on one thing. In terms of time of day or things, for people with type 1 diabetes, the safest time to do it is first thing in the morning, before they have their breakfast. And there is quite a lot of evidence just from general studies that if you get up and do your exercise before you do anything else in the day, you're much more likely to stick to that pattern because things don't get in the way, and you're much more likely to adhere to that and keep doing it. So that's what we do try and recommend, that people, if they can, that it's the first thing they do, and then they come back and have their breakfast, and then they head off to work.
What about type 2 drug treatment? How does this affect exercise?
So type 2 diabetes drugs, in terms of worrying about low blood sugars, the only two agents that can cause blood sugars to go down are the sulfonylureas, which the commonest is glycoside, and insulin. Although the risk is really quite low, because of the fact that people with type 2 diabetes are still producing some of their own insulin. And we know if you're producing some of your own insulin, sounds a bit strange, but the byproduct of producing your own insulin, something called C-peptide, is actually protective from having low blood sugars. So that helps stop the low blood sugars happening. It can happen. The most common place it would happen, which is surprising, but is if you exercise within an hour of your meal, because that's the time when your insulin level is the highest. And also, if you're on a sulfonylurea, is the time when you will have the drug will have stimulated you to produce the most insulin, and that's then makes it the point when you're at most risk. So slightly perverse, you're at more risk of having a hypo with type 2 diabetes if you exercise after your meal than if you exercise before your meal. The other drugs are pretty safe. Interestingly, when we look at how they interact, some of them actually cause your blood sugars to slightly go up. So metformin in trials, if you compare people on metformin and not on metformin, the acute effect of being on metformin is your glucose doesn't fall as much as on metformin in that acute period when you exercise, which is surprising because you would expect it might go up, but that might be due just to other mechanisms of the way it acts. But the other ones are all safe.
Right.
One of the things that clearly comes up when you look at why it is that people have given up exercise is that they tend to try and escalate too quickly, or they start too high. And if you start too high, you can either get just standard things such as a lot of muscle aching and things, and that puts you off the exercise, or you can have injuries. So it's very clear that unfortunately, the turtle is the one that wins the race, that if you, rather than the hare, that if you take it slowly and gradually build it, you're much more likely at 6 months to still be doing the exercise than the people who head off at a sprint and escalate very quickly. So it's just a question of just having a very easy target that you build up and get to, and you're much more likely to keep doing it.
And why is it so important to break up periods of sitting?
So, yeah, this has been a very surprising thing. It came from a couple of early studies in which we had done one study that we had shown with people with type 2 diabetes that when they exercised, when we looked at their standard exercise, they didn't seem to be getting as much improvement as we expected. And what most people do when they exercise is that they then sit for a lot longer. So if a chap goes out for a run for 2 hours, he probably spends about 2 hours doing very little after the run. And that led us to kind of think, well, actually, maybe breaking up just sitting around is important. So there's been a number of trials that have looked at just getting people to stand six times in an hour, and have shown that if you do that and they stand for a minute, that lowers the glucose. So actually just breaking up the sitting is enough to lower the glucose. And in females, they get an additional benefit that it also helps lower their fats. Unfortunately, it doesn't do that in men.
And how does tech help, things like Fitbits or Apple Watches?
So the studies in people with type 2 diabetes and people without type 2 diabetes, there hasn't actually been any in people with type 1 diabetes, has shown that people who embrace technology, particularly Fitbits and things like that, are much more likely to stick to an exercise. And I suppose that we see that with other things, that if you get reinforcement of what you're doing, it makes it more likely for you to do things. So if you have a Fitbit or something that's measuring your things, then that can have a real effect. You get a much, much, much more pronounced effect if your healthcare worker either agreed to share it with them and they comment on it. Then you get a real huge effect, because then you're reinforcing how important it is. Or if you just ask them about it in clinic and note it down, so you can reinforce that even more if the healthcare person asks about it. There's very clear evidence that people who have diabetes, if they exercise, will get the benefit that the general population gets, that they're less likely to get cancer, less likely to get dementia, less likely to get heart disease, and just will feel much, much better, much better. They're less likely to get stress at work. So even if you don't feel it's helping your glucose control, it's still doing lots and lots of really good things that will make you feel better.
Marathon runner Frank Rogers, who is also a qualified coach with England Athletics, relates his experience of being diagnosed with type 1 since 2012. He sets out some useful exercise and training guides in his new book, Running with Diabetes. He recalled that discovering he had type 1 came as a big shock.
I had the massive weight loss, so I knew that there was something wrong. But I was training for one of my marathons, so I thought the weight loss was tied in with the marathon training that I was doing. But it was excessive. It was more weight loss than should have been matching up with the training. So I knew something was wrong, and I was going to toilet quite a bit. And I had symptoms, and they had progressively got worse over like the last 6 months. But I kind of ignored them. I thought, no, it'll either go away or it'll get worse. And it didn't go away, it just got worse.
Yeah. And you didn't, presumably it affected your running performance.
Oh yeah, massively. I was finishing runs and I was having hypos, but back then I didn't even know what a hypo was. So I was just massively hungry. And finish a race, I would do like a 10-mile race, which isn't that far. And I'd finish and I would eat like 3 or 4 bananas in one go, and my coach at the time was saying, why are you eating so much? Because I'm hungry. And that was how I was balancing it, because I still had some insulin being produced, but with the running, the more I ran, the quicker I ran out, so I was having to eat quite a lot. And it didn't matter what I was eating, I was still losing weight. So I thought, this is fine, I can eat what I like, this is great. That lasted for about 3 or 4 months, and then it just got worse.
Yeah. Did you know anybody else living with type 1?
Oh, no, I knew absolutely nothing about type 1. I didn't even know what diabetes was. I thought, like a lot of people, I thought you got it from eating too many sweets. Yeah. That was my level of ignorance back then. Nobody knew had diabetes. It wasn't in the family, and I had no awareness of it. Absolutely none.
If I can ask you, what age were you diagnosed at?
I was 39.
Right.
Yes, right.
Yeah, yeah. Well, so you were a bodybuilder but switched to running. Was this before your diagnosis?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I started bodybuilding. Originally was back in school. I was a boxer, so I was a boxer for a number of years. And there was a bit of weightlifting involved in that. And then about 14, 15, I started lifting weights at home. And then I went to the gym. I just did weightlifting all through university. So I went to university, qualified as a solicitor, kept me weightlifting up. But as I was doing the weightlifting, I was also a dancer. And I was a dance company, and that folded when I was about 34, 35. So I had a massive aerobic hole in my training, and to deal with it, because the minute the dance company folded, I put on quite a bit of weight, which I wasn't massively happy with. So in order to replace the aerobic exercise back into my training plan, I took up running.
Right.
And that kind of, the running kind of took over, because I was a salsa instructor as well for a couple of years. So I was about 34, 35 this time. And then I started running. And like I say, the running just took over. So I transitioned from being a bodybuilder and weightlifting 5 to 6 times a week to running 5 to 6 times a week.
Okay. So can you explain your work with England Athletics UK? You're helping them create guidelines for clubs and running groups to help support individuals?
Yeah, England Athletics are great. They're like the governing body for all the athletics. So all the athletics you see on TV, all the running, that all starts at England Athletics. So if you've ever run a race, they do the licensing for it as well. So they're basically in charge of it, and that's where all the sport in England comes from. You get trained up with them, and they have an inclusion policy, which is lovely. And they had this great video, and they had different groups represented all in a line. They had people with dwarfism or restricted growth, people with hearing impairments, people with visual impairments, wheelchair users, people with autism, people with amputations. And as I was looking down this line of different people in the inclusion policy, I noticed I wasn't there.
Right.
And then I did a bit of research on the numbers, and I noticed that if you're living with diabetes, we're the biggest group. And I think there was more people living with diabetes than there were nearly than everybody else in the inclusion policy put together.
Mm.
It wasn't quite that bad, but the numbers were fairly around the same. So I got onto England Flex and said, look, you've got this inclusion policy. It's lovely. It's really nice. What about me and basically everybody else living with diabetes? Because as you know, living with diabetes is one of these invisible conditions.
Yep.
And the problem with that is, it then becomes a barrier. If you don't see yourself represented in sport or anything, and there's no positive reinforcement, then it becomes quite isolating, and you think, I can't run. Because I run marathons. And I thought, when I was diagnosed, I thought, as soon as they explained what diabetes was to me, I thought, well, that's it, I can't run anymore, and I can't run marathons anymore, which was nonsense, of course can. But at the time, when you get diagnosed, it can feel like your options have massively narrowed down. And part of that is because we're not represented. We bring it on ourselves a little bit, I feel, as a group, because sometimes we can quietly just get on with stuff. And we, rather than be a bit more militant and say, look, I've got diabetes, it doesn't define me, I can still do everything I could do before diabetes, it's just a bit more complicated.
Yeah.
So I went on to England Athletics, and I told them that, look, you need a new policy, because there's this massive section of society that are not being represented, and I think you kind of should. So we had a couple of chats, and I wrote the policy for them. And then they did a focus on a running story, which was about me, because I feel that we needed representation. You need to be able to look at people and say, well, look, they do running. They're not that good, but they can still go out, and they can still compete, and they can still perform, and they can still run at quite a high level. If they can do it, then I can do it. And that was the whole point of it. So that took a while, and now basically they had an inclusion policy, but there was just no mention of diabetes, and now it's there. And the good thing about it is it's for the coaches and the run leaders, so it's the people who are coaching, just so one, that they know what diabetes is, because if they were like me, they wouldn't have a clue what it was. It doesn't take that long to explain it. And then if you get somebody who's got diabetes and they want to run, or they want to do long jump or throw discus or shot put or anything athletic based, it's just how to include them and what they, and just really basic entry level information, so that they can include them. So yeah, that was part of it. And then the other part was the representation, just so that if you sat there with diabetes and you think that you can't run or you can't do long jump or you can't throw javelins, of course you can. So it's just to raise awareness and also just be a bit inspiring.
Yeah. Yeah. So you've written Running with Diabetes. Is this the world's first running book specifically written for anybody living with diabetes who wants to run?
It is, because this was the other thing. Well, when I was doing the stuff with England Athletics, I said to them, look, there's absolutely nothing for us. If I wasn't a coach, because I qualified in 2013, I was an assistant coach in 2011, got diabetes in 2012, then qualified as a full coach in 2013. And what I said to England Athletics is, look, there's nothing for us. There's one book by Sherry Colberg, which is very good, and it's got two pages, which is nice, but that was it. There was absolutely nothing else. And again, if you're wanting to start running, and you like the idea of it, the easiest way to do it is, right, I'll get a book and I'll have a look at it. And there was no books out there. And I thought that was a shame, because I know that for me, I'm living with type 1 diabetes. I know that running is a massive part of how I manage my condition. And if I wasn't running, I know that I would struggle. I would struggle quite a bit. And the management of my diabetes wouldn't be anywhere near as good as it is. And I wouldn't be achieving any of my outcomes that I want. Like, you have different goals about what you want, about how you want your HbA1c level to be. And if I didn't have the running or some sort of sport or exercise, I know that I would struggle massively to manage diabetes.
I talked to Frank for a further 20 minutes in some detail about the contents of his book. So we've actually put that on a standalone Living with Diabetes podcast special, if you'd like to hear more. Frank's book, Running with Diabetes, is available on Amazon for $14.99 and also comes in a Kindle version.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a monthly podcast from DRWF. My Desmond is an online education course for people living with type 2. I talked to Alison Northern, an implementation manager at the Leicester Diabetes Centre, to discover more about the course and how people can access it remotely, something which may be particularly helpful during the coronavirus restrictions.
Yeah, so Desmond itself stands for Diabetes Education and Self-Management for Ongoing and Newly Diagnosed. It's a collaboratively developed education programme for those with type 2 diabetes. So back in 2003, there were people, healthcare professionals from across the UK, really, that came together to design a national program. Really, they wanted to use what they've been learning in their local areas and bring it together to develop one curriculum. A curriculum was developed for those people newly diagnosed with type 2 diabetes, and that was piloted, and then it went through a randomized controlled trial. So they were, you know, given that opportunity to look at whether that 6-hour group-based program had an effect on those people attending. And there's published papers about this available on the internet. But we showed that there was a reduction in HbA1c. People reduced their weight, more people gave up smoking, people increased their physical activities, all as a result of attending that 6-hour group-based education. Whilst that work was going on back in 2006, we also then began a national rollout. There was a push nationally to start making such groups available. So we began then offering healthcare providers across the UK the opportunity to train with us and then begin delivering Desmond groups, you know, to their patients in their local areas. And that continues to this day. So we then use that curriculum and the basis of that content, which obviously we continue to make sure meets national guidance and all of that. But we use that curriculum then to develop My Desmond, so our online version of the program, really. So we launched My Desmond just almost 2 years ago now. You know, we know that we have to move with the times, and we need to be aware that one size does not fit all, groups aren't for everyone. So this is an alternative, but also can be provided for people once they've been to group, they can have this as a follow on. And obviously in these current times of, you know, COVID-19 outbreak, this gives us an opportunity for those people that would normally be going to group a chance to learn about diabetes, what's going on in their body, and those kind of key messages really around diet, physical activity, lifestyle, learning to self-manage really from the beginning.
So how do people access this new online version, My Desmond, and do they need a referral?
So, yeah, really depends on where in the country the patients are. But ultimately, if anybody's really interested in signing up to My Desmond and having a look on the programme and seeing what they can learn, then we would just say in the first instance, drop us an email. So the email address is myDesmond@uhl-tr.nhs.uk. And then we will put them in touch either with their local provider of Desmond, or we ourselves at the Leicester Diabetes Centre will add them to the programme themselves. Now, we would always prefer them to be sent over to their local Desmond teams that are within their local area, because they can link back to their primary care physicians and that kind of thing. Whereas us over at the Leicester Diabetes Centre don't have those links. So we would prefer that option. But ultimately, patients can get access via any means as long as they get in touch with us, and then we'll point them in the right direction.
I think we've got that link on the website, haven't we?
I think you have, yes.
Yeah, on the DRWF website. So if people are struggling, they can always go there or Google search for My Desmond online.
Yeah,
they'll probably bring it up, won't it?
Yeah, so mydesmond.com, sorry.
Brilliant. So how does this differ from face-to-face sessions?
Yeah, so all of the key messages, you know, that are in those group sessions are included on the My Desmond platform. Obviously, they may be presented in a slightly different way because we've had to rethink about how you do that from those in groups. How do we do that online? But we have a number of learning sessions on the platform, so they have videos, quizzes, animations, there may be some text to read or a link to an external reliable source. But all of those key messages around diet, physical activity, what's going on in the body, all of that is within the My Desmond program. So actually, in terms of its content, it is very similar. The one beauty of us doing something online, though, actually means we can go further. Because obviously, as you can imagine, in a 6-hour group, there's only so much you can discuss. You know, you've only got 6 hours, and that soon finishes. So we're online, we have the opportunity to offer more information as well.
So people can learn a lot more, as you say, than they could in a session maybe, and ask maybe more or find out personal questions.
Yeah, exactly. So there's a range of information or educational material that's available the moment that they log into the programme. But then we have these 8 weekly booster sessions as well. So they bring in new topics like foot care or relapse prevention. So where somebody's made a lifestyle change, but trying to keep them, keep them going, really. And other things where things like reducing sedentary behaviour, so getting people to stand more, or where to find sources for good muscle training activities, all those information, that information which wouldn't normally, you know, you wouldn't be able to explore that much in a face-to-face, can be found in the My Desmond programme. And one of the big things as well is obviously doing something online. What we were really conscious of was about providing patients with the opportunity to still chat with and network with other people with diabetes. we wanted to include that opportunity in My Desmond in as close as we could get it to what we would do in a group. So we developed a chat forum. So people can post their questions, their queries. We've got people putting how well they're doing and how they've achieved it. And then people can comment on it, make further suggestions, and they can really still learn from each other whilst also obviously going through that educational material that's built into the programme as well.
And certainly at the moment when everybody is isolated, that's probably even better, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, it's just a real opportunity for everybody to be learning, looking at ways and how they can all work together and keep that, each other going during this time, really.
Alison Northern. And a reminder of their website for more information, which is at mydesmond.com.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
Life under lockdown when you're living with diabetes can be a worrying and challenging time, particularly if you're shielding. I've been talking to Lee Calladine, DRWF's event manager, who lives with type 1.
I've had type 1 diabetes for almost 20 years. I've been on multiple daily injections since day one and never changed to anything like a pump or my regimen. I manage it as tightly as I can and keep good control, always maintain good HbA1c's and followed the guidance from my diabetes team and the NHS around diet and exercise, injection technique and all of the other things that that I'm supposed to do as a person living with type 1 diabetes.
So you also received a letter saying you were going to have to self-isolate. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. So once it became clear that the virus meant people with certain conditions who were classed as at risk had to work from home or self-isolate, I received a letter pretty promptly from the government, and the letter had full instructions on about how long I was going to be isolated, what kind of things I should or shouldn't do, and some guidelines of who I should contact, like my GP or the hospital if I didn't feel very well or if I was showing symptoms of the virus. But really the letter was about limiting your risk and making sure that you isolated and didn't put yourself at any risk.
When you are poorly, it really affects your diabetes, doesn't it? So I know this is a viral infection. The latest report talks about, people with type 1 when you get a bacterial infection, but any infection can really throw your blood sugars, can't it?
Oh, absolutely. Sometimes my blood sugars alert me to the fact that something's not quite right before I even show any symptoms of an infection or a virus. And that can be anything from like a common cold up to, I don't know, perhaps you've got an infection in your fingernail or anything like that that can happen, even minor stuff. It seems to affect my blood sugar levels and usually it pushes them high, and my normal management, so I would take a corrective dose to try and bring my blood sugars down. I might reduce or increase my background insulin and just try to manage my doses and my diet to bring it back down. But I can normally tell if there's something not right or if I've already got a cold or an infection, because it does push my blood sugars up and they become much harder to control. But again, there's guidance from the NHS on that, from your team, and they instruct you on what to do, which usually means taking corrective doses of insulin every couple of hours, drinking lots of water and doing lots and lots of testing.
So, Lee, have you got any advice for anybody else in a similar position to yourself? And is there anything that you would point to on the DRWF website and resources that you think is useful?
Yeah, I think the best advice I would give to people is what I've followed myself, and that is just focus on the NHS guidelines for isolating and protecting yourself from COVID. I didn't really follow the government guidance because it seemed to fluctuate and change as the weeks went by. So I followed my diabetes team's advice, the NHS guidelines, and I also think looking at information that is good verified information. So DRWF have got some amazing leaflets about all different aspects of living with diabetes. The Managing Diabetes While You Are Ill is a really good one, which could be handy at the moment. The website's always updated with great news and information, especially the latest NHS and diabetes information. And I think, yeah, just protect yourself, follow the guidance, stay at home, stay safe.
So have you heard from your specialist diabetes team at the hospital?
Yes. Even though the clinic's not open and operating normally at the moment, they are doing appointments and reviews via Zoom. So I've spoken to my consultant at the hospital and had my diabetes review to look at my HbA1c results and the results and data from my Libre and my blood glucose tests via a video call, which was great.
Yeah, excellent.
Yeah, and it meant, you know, not going to the hospital, not having to get parking and pay for parking. And the team at the hospital said, as a trial, this is actually working really great, and they might roll it out even after the COVID crisis is over.
Research into COVID-19 fatalities in the UK has indicated a high proportion of people living with diabetes. While media headlines have been quite dramatic, it appears that the correlation is mainly in line with older people and often with other health challenges. To put this into context, our regular contributor, Dr. Partha Carr, a national speciality advisor on diabetes with NHS England, has been looking at the data and posted this analysis on social media.
And understandably, there was a lot of worry and anxiety, so we'll try and, as a system, try and support everybody. But just a quick few things to sort of mention. Don't forget that the most important determinant in this is age. And the average age of death in type 1 diabetes was around 72 years old, and for type 2 diabetes was about 78. As with anything across the board with COVID-19, age continues to be the big determinant. Type 1 diabetes does indeed carry more risk than type 2 diabetes. But for parents out there, which straight away raises anxiety, I think it's important to note that the absolute risk below the age of 40 is low. Until the data has been analysed date, there's been no deaths recorded below the age of 20. So that's reassuring. And we are speaking to paediatric colleagues and associations to look at their views as well. As regards shielding, all the data has been given to the chief medical officer to consider. But as is very evident from the data, it's not binary. It's based on your age, your glucose control, your weight. And I think on that note, the important things to mention is that there are a couple of things which we can't modify in life. We can't change your age. We can't change your ethnicity. But we can probably impact on the weight as well as the glucose control. It's important also to look at the data, which suggests that, you want to have an optimal range. It's not about to being too low in any respect. So that's an important message as well. But another thing which we should not forget is the issue of socioeconomic deprivation. That's something which is modifiable to an extent, and we all have a part in it. So please, let's not forget about that either. But overall, the data hopefully should help shape what we do next, where we are. The NHS is here to help. We've got a national advice helpline set up, and there are self-management platforms coming out for type 1 diabetes, type 2 diabetes, all to help people. And there is no lack of people out there to help. So stay safe. We're here to take questions. Keep washing those hands. There is no doubt at the end we'll come out through this.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
You're listening to Living with Diabetes, a monthly podcast from DRWF. It's a challenging time to be fundraising for charities, and DRWF is no different. I spoke with our Head of Community Fundraising, Tim Green, to discover more.
As a fundraiser and heading up the fundraising team, it's to try and create that sense of community togetherness, particularly at the moment in a difficult period we're all going through, in search of that common goal, which is obviously to find a cure for diabetes and support those living with.
So all of our fundraising events have been cancelled or postponed at the moment. So what kind of things can people do to support the charity now?
Well, indeed, you're right. A number have been cancelled and postponed, which is worrying for a charity. However, the landscape is so that we can still do many of our events virtually, which does add some challenges, admittedly. But we can still ask people to go out and run and walk and cycle, adhering to the government guidelines, of course. But they can still do that daily exercise and incorporate that with a challenge for DRWF. We've also started to create virtual campaigns such as Donate Your Fuel, in which we're encouraging people to donate what they would have spent getting to and from work to the charity. That's kind of an immediate answer to the postponements and cancellations. But what we need to really tell people that are looking to support us is we can still have people sign up for the back end of this year. So, for example, we have a Spinnaker Tail, Absal, Skydives, a London 10K. There's many, many opportunities. They do fall, you know, in the latter part of the year. But let's get people on board now. Let's sign people up now. And let's begin that fundraising momentum now as well and get that much needed cash into the charity.
So why is it important for people to continue to fundraise for DRWF?
Well, you know, it is important because whilst the country may have stopped in some terms and we are working from home and businesses have stopped, research doesn't stop and most certainly must continue. And without that much needed income from fundraisers and the voluntary sector, which is what we rely on so much, that research is really at risk and we cannot enable that to happen. So we really must rally the troops, get our supporters and followers on board and continue to fundraise.
Brilliant. Is there any help and advice you can offer, and can people still get in touch with DRWF for their help?
Yeah, absolutely. So all of our normal connection points, whether that be social media, whether that be the telephone, email, it's all still active. It's all still being managed wonderfully by our team. We are working remotely, like much of the country, but it's all still there. It's all still working. We're going into the office on a rotated basis to collect posts. So, you know, if people are sending in donations, they're still being picked up. Please do recognise that. Contact us, get in touch, phone, email, and the support we can give you is very much the same as what it would be on a normal landscape, whether that's a one-to-one with a fundraiser. If you're not sure what to do, we can offer you that support the same day to ensure that you've got all the tools at your disposal to do what you need to do.
Great. Is there a way people can team up at home?
Yeah, so virtually, that's one really good thing that's come out of this particular crisis is with Skype and Zoom and various other ways that people can connect virtually via their laptop, iPhones and other devices is to do virtual quizzes. There's many families out there in the UK that are doing quizzes on a Friday night, paying a donation and all getting together. Not only are you catching up with the loved ones that you most dearly want to see, but you're also making a difference in the community as well. If you're we've worked with families that are having a bit of competitive nature within a husband and wife setting. So how many press-ups and sit-ups can each person do in a day? And the winner cooks dinner. The loser cooks dinner and the winner gets to enjoy. So, you know, there are many ways that you can team up at home and really keep that fun aspect going in what is a difficult period.
Can you still send out T-shirts to people?
Yeah, absolutely. So as I mentioned before, we have a rota in which people are going into the office and ensuring that things are coming out and keeping on top of. And one of those things is any requests for T-shirts, running vests, cycling vests, et cetera, for our fundraisers can be picked up, packaged and dropped off to the secure Royal Mail point at the our centre where we work out of. So absolutely, if people are looking to get that piece of material on their body that's really shouting DRWF, then we can absolutely get that organised and sent out to you.
Great. Anything else you'd like to add, Tim?
I think we've covered a lot there in terms of how important it is for DRWF to keep moving forward, the research to keep moving forward, but ultimately the fundraising to keep moving forward and coming in. We really must not stand still in what is a really difficult time for the country and many charities as well. We must not forget that. But, you know, our focus is ensuring that those living with type 1, type 2 and many other aspects of diabetes is looked after. And so I'd urge anyone listening to this, if you can do something, get involved, however big or small, it really does not matter. We need you to get behind us at a difficult time and really make the difference.
British cricketing legend Sir Ian Botham, OBE, has led a call for people to support DRWF to continue vital work funding diabetes research during the COVID-19 pandemic. Sir Ian is no stranger to the challenges faced by families with diabetes. His daughter Becky has type 1 and has had to self-isolate. We're extremely fortunate to have Sir Ian and his family supporting DRWF and encouraging people to dig deep to help our important diabetes research to continue. This is what Sir Ian had to say in a short message of support posted to social media.
These are difficult times for all of us, and even more than ever, charities require your help and support. By supporting DRWF, you will enable the continuation of funding much needed research and providing support for people living with diabetes.
DRWF, staying well until a cure is found.
And that brings us to the end of this edition of DRWF's podcast, Living with Diabetes. To keep up to date with the latest news and information, or to discover how you can continue to support DRWF at this challenging time, please visit the website at drwf.org.uk. This is Claire Levy from Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. Our thanks to all the people who talked to us and also to you for listening. I'm looking forward to joining you again in our next edition of Living with Diabetes.
Living with Diabetes is a Blue Aurora Media production for DRWF. Copyright 2020 Diabetes Research and Wellness Foundation. All rights reserved.